Hello, this is Dave Lynn, senior editor of thecorporatecounsel.net and a partner at Morrison & Foerster, and welcome to the Deep Dive with Dave podcast. I hope the audience will indulge me for this episode as I take a deep dive of a personal nature rather than talking about a securities law topic. It's been a year since my great friend and collaborator Marty Dunn passed away, and I wanted to find a way to pay tribute to him. It's been a tough year without Marty, and I know his family and many friends feel the same way. And over the last year, I've from time to time gone back and listened to prior episodes of the Dave and Marty radio show just so I could hear Marty's voice again and relive some of the great times that we had together. And it occurred to me that a great way to pay tribute to Marty was to actually do it in his own voice. So I've compiled a selection of Marty's greatest hits from the Dave and Marty radio show into this episode of the Deep Dive with Dave podcast. First up, a fond memory I have from our speaking engagements together is when we would play the game, Which is Better?, which always seemed to elicit a laugh from the audience. Early last year, we recorded what turned out to be our last performance of Which is Better?, and I'm so glad we got to do it one more time.
So now, pursuant to fan requests, we're reviving one of our features from many years ago, Which is Better?, which is where we present two alternatives and we discuss which one we think is better.
And Dave likes to present this to me as kind of a Colin Jost, Michael Che, Saturday Night Live Christmas skit, where he doesn't really give me the topics in advance, so whatever you're going to get is top of my head, so it's going to be real, man. It's going to be honest. So these are going to be my views on which I think these are better. Dave's had time to think about it. Dave's more of a planner.
Okay, first, which is better, Megxit or Brexit?
See, to me, no question, because I'm a huge Meghan Markle fan from Deal or No Deal days. So, yeah, I'm going to go Megxit.
Okay. Yeah, I'll go Megxit, too. I think any person who's a father or a husband kind of knows, you know, sometimes you just want to get out of all the craziness and just start over again. So I can relate to Harry on that. All right, now delving into some primetime television, The Masked Singer versus The Voice.
Now, I have deep knowledge of each of these because I watched each once. I'm going to go with The Voice just because I like Kelly Clarkson. Deep thought.
I'm going to go with Masked Singer. Masked Singer burst onto the scene last year with an amazing concept that was borrowed from South Korea television where singers get up dressed in a costume and people have to guess who they are. I did watch The Voice for a few seasons, but then when Adam Levine left, I lost interest.
I will say the Saturday Night Live with Eddie Murphy where he did Buckwheat on The Masked Singer was fantastic.
I missed that. How did I miss that? All right, now to, because it's around lunchtime, how about Impossible Burger versus the Beyond Burger?
I have only had the Beyond Burger, and I bought it at the grocery store and made it into patties at home, and it was some of the grossest looking and feeling stuff I've ever been around food that sold itself as food. But it actually, I just cooked it to death, and it tasted like a burger, so it was fine. I really think on either it's going to be, yeah, okay, good.
I haven't tried either of them, but one of these days I'm going to work up the nerve to do it. Now, this relates to your choices with regard to your latte. Do you like oat milk or almond milk?
I'm going to take your Impossible Beyond Burger answer on this. I have no idea what you're talking about. Linda drinks almond milk, so I'll go with almond milk.
I find these nut milks and oat milks disgusting. I just can't drink them. I try, and then I spit them out, basically.
Well, I can't tell you how many times I've walked past the office, and Dave's trying to get milk from an almond. It's really embarrassing. It's just all in all embarrassing.
The Oscars recently happened, and there were a lot of movies up. Among the ones who didn't win Best Picture were Joker versus Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
The truth of the matter is, I saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and liked it very much. I will never see The Joker. If there is zero, I would sooner watch a Harley Quinn movie than a Joker movie. And so, and I'm never going to see either. So I got to go, even as Tarantino, but I got to go Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Okay. Now, this is one I know you have some experience with. Electric car versus internal combustion engine car.
See, this is something, because, man, you know, my first car was a Firebird with a 406-pack on it that you could fly if it had wings. And so I love the power there. But I got to tell you, my little electric car, you put your foot on the gas, it just goes. And it doesn't spool up. It doesn't do anything. And I'm going to go electric car. I've really become an electric car fan. I like watching the electric car F1 racing more than the F1 racing to watch them take off. And so I'm going to go electric. I know you're not.
Yeah, that's tough for me. That's tough. I haven't tried electric yet because I'm just an old gearhead that loves muscle cars, so it makes it tough for me to go down that road.
I totally respect that.
I gotta stick with who I am.
I think if you ask my older brother, he might beat me about the head and shoulders for my answer, so he still has his Z28, his 69.
Next, Marty and I spent a lot of time in our formative years in garages working on cars, so the topic of cars seemed to come up quite a bit during the course of our radio show. Here's a selection of our conversations.
Something people don't know about both Dave and I is we spent a bit of our time working on cars at Summit Point Raceway in our teenage years. And so the follow-up question to transparency by the staff would be, if you had to pick your favorite muscle car, what would it be and why? Mine is the 68 Firebird. First car I ever had, I built the engine for, and it was a 68 Firebird with a 406-pack on it, steering wheel that was about 8 inches around. And I love that car. That car met its unfortunate demise two blocks from my house when the fact that I had done the electrical work came back to haunt me and it caught fire. So that would still be my favorite. It's almost the same car, but I had the big block and the power behind it. But I would give anything to have a 68 Firebird again.
Yeah, I guess I had an important question I wanted to ask you, which was generated by the fact that I went to a little British car show over the weekend, and I was wondering what was your favorite British sports car.
Well, first off, I want to say, after the concert discussion, I'm a little hurt that you didn't invite me to the British car show, because you know how that would have been the way I would have loved to have spent a Saturday. Walking around a British car show with one of those beer hats with you would have been a great weekend. It's interesting about British cars, because when I was a teenager, my older brother and a friend of his named Tom opened an auto garage in Bladensburg called Total Auto. We took an old car wash and turned it into an auto garage. And my job there was to clean parts and sit on stuff so it wouldn't blow away, mostly. But I got to watch them make some really cool cars, and they raced them and all that. And they had a 1968 Triumph GT6 that had a massive engine, and we were discussing this before. Somehow or another, they figured out how to mesh that with a Fiat 5-speed transmission that they had to make their own parts. And that thing would fly. And when we put the engine in, it was so big we had to modify the hood, so we drove it without a hood for a while. And I loved that car. It was so cool looking. The front end was huge. It was this cool blue, had the hatchback on it. It was a great ride. It was cool to tool around it.
Yeah, that sounds like fun. I actually was raising the British car discussion, so we sound a little bit more erudite than we really are. But
I guess I brought that back.
Yeah, so is that their muscle car discussion elicited some responses like, you guys are so lowbrow. But anyway, I guess that proves that you can't change reality there.
What about the old Jags with the huge front ends?
Yeah, the XK.
They had V12s in them, didn't they?
They had V12s. Uh-huh. They had six-cylinders and V12s.
Yeah, that was
and,
a
the,
massive
and the wheels were inside the fender. It was a beautiful, beautiful car.
So in listening to Dave talk about this, I've owned, I think, 5 cars in my whole life. I had a Firebird I built. I bought a Plymouth Satellite that used to be a police car. I had a Honda Civic, a Honda Accord, and I've been driving the same 92 pickup truck that I bought from Chris Owings for the last 12 years. So I got 5 cars. You must have had 30 cars in your life.
Probably something
like
that.
That's ridiculous. You enjoy them a lot more than I do, though. I truly do view them as just a means from one side to the other, although it is nice when they look good. There's no question about it.
Well, mine never really looked good, but I'm a gearhead. I got to admit it.
Yeah, my brother has had some great cars that I was fortunate enough to ride in or drive or ruin or yeah, whatever, but right, mine have always been pretty pedestrian.
Well, let's turn to something that I think is probably more of a dire situation, which is I hear tell that you may be driving around an electric car these days.
It's not purely electric.
And I wonder how that reflects on your muscle car street cred.
I've thought about this a lot. And I've gotten a lot of, oh, you're Ed Begley Jr. now, and all that kind of grief that you get from guys who have known me since I was a kid. Lynn and I went out and we bought a Chevy Volt, okay? It's not pure electric. It's actually got a lot of pep, which I like, but it's mainly an electric car. I got to plug.
I mean, you do plug it in, right?
I do plug it in every night at home, which is a little embarrassing. But I've thought about this a lot. I drive 10 miles from PG County to work every day and back.
why should I burn fossil fuels? We all know a muscle car going down Rhode Island Avenue at two stoplights every 150 yards is really not reasonable anymore. So while my brother still has a number of muscle cars down on his farm in Prince Frederick where he has some open road and can burn it, I'm old, Dave. I'm old. You know, I'm giving in, man. So I think it hurts my cred a little. I'm not going to lie to you, but I'm willing to live with it. I would still, at some point in time, I'm definitely going to go back and buy a 69 Firebird and really show the world how it works. But right now, I'm okay with it.
Well,
you going to cut me some slack or not?
Listen, you got to do what you got to do. I think one day we should settle this argument by having a little street race, meet you and your Volt, me and my 2011 Camaro SS. I'll give you a few cars, and we'll see which one.
You know what we'll do?
Does the quarter mile?
We'll do both. We'll do a first race on who goes the quarter mile fastest, and then we'll see who goes the farthest on a tank of gas. I think we'll split that battle.
Maybe we can do it on which one has the bigger carbon footprint.
Yes, and I think if it comes down to who's more impressed, you'll probably.
And with that, we'll turn to our holiday topic because it is our holiday show. And the topic I was thinking about is, what is your favorite Christmas present when you were a kid?
You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about it because we always had really great Christmases. My mom was into it, but there's no one thing that ever really stood out to me as far as like a great present. You know, I mean, one year she got 50-pound dumbbells. You know, that was really cool, and I like that. But
that's heavy.
Yeah, well, I was younger. And the two things I'll always remember is my mother had this tradition that you should have something to play with when you came downstairs, set up, ready. And every year we would come downstairs and she would have a racetrack set up right in the middle of the floor. And you could start racing HO cars or whatever gauge cars she had there. And that was just fun. And, of course, we trashed the track by the end of the day every time. And, you know, we'd put the pieces together and start building a super track at some point. But I really liked that tradition of just having a toy to open when you came down. The one present I always remember in our family that made the biggest splash is when my older brother's about 6 years older than me, so he was driving when I was, you know, little. He had this really money 1972 Ford station wagon that he owned an auto garage, right? And so he had tricked it out, had a great engine on it, and had a metallic blue paint job on the thing, and it was so loud when he left for school in the morning. You could hear the knocker on the front door shake. That's how you knew he was leaving. And when our neighbors one year, actually, the father there was ill and didn't want to be woken up in the morning, so my brother would have to push the car down the street to open it at the end of the street. And one year, I guess he was probably 17 or 18, my mother gave him a set of Kregers to put on it. And most Kregers. People today will not know what Kregers are. Kregers were the rims on your wheels that were like four spokes. I think it was four really thick spokes with the blue Kreger emblem in the middle. And it was the blue went with the blue paint job. Oh, I mean, we're talking about a station wagon, by the way, but it was one of the hottest looking things I'd ever seen. It was great.
Marty and I spent a lot of time on the road traveling around to speak at conferences all over the country. Next up are some of Marty's observations on the good and bad of our travels.
Okay, we always like to finish up with one topic that has nothing to do with securities law and probably only interests Dave and I. But so my topic for this week, because I got to pick it, is I travel all over the place, as does Dave, doing CLEs. Have done this since probably 93. And you find your favorite places as you travel along, and all of you all, I'm sure, have gone to various conferences, and you know, you're there by yourself and you have nothing else to do, so you usually find somewhere to spend the evening hanging out, maybe watching a movie, maybe having a beer, maybe doing whatever. So my question for Dave this week is, in all our your CLE travels, and I'm going to accept the trip we had in Vancouver where we hung out at a place we can't remember the name, in all of your CLE travels, what's your favorite place to hang out when you do one of the trips?
Well, it's tough since you excluded one of my favorite places.
My favorite place ever on these trips is a bar on Coronado called McPee's. The windows are wide open. The breeze is blowing through. The bartender's a great guy. Everybody there is great. It's a wonderful place to hang out. And fortunately, in 3 weeks, I'll be out there for the Annual Institute on Coronado at the Dell, and I'm going to get to go back and see my favorite place. I'm pretty excited about it. I think that's the top for me. There are a lot of other good ones, and I don't want to embarrass myself by saying how many I've been to, but that's my favorite place probably to hang out in the world, actually.
Hello, everyone. It's Dave Lynn here, and we're doing the Dave and Marty radio show, and we have a special treat this week. We're doing this as a remote job from the legendary Hotel Del Coronado in California, where Marty and I just wrapped up time speaking at the 37th Annual Securities Regulation Institute put on by Northwestern Law School.
Dave and I were actually thinking of topics today, and I wanted to talk about my favorite cartoons, but Dave thought that that was too immature, so I wasn't allowed to go with that, although Foghorn Leghorn is a god, is all I'm going to say. So I have three bad travel stories that always stick out for me, and not surprisingly, they were all when I was at the government, not since I've left. The first one that I'll always remember is I had to write a release on a plane, and of course, I'm in the narrowest seat on the plane, so I'm only starting with about 14 inches between my nose and the seat in front of me anyhow, and the guy in front of me, of course, reclines completely. And so I have my laptop, and I can only open it to about 20 degrees. And so there's no way I can even see what I'm typing. However, everybody knows me. I was a clerk typist at USDA in college, so I can type pretty well. And so I spent the entire flight typing blindly, and then every 5 minutes or so opening it into the aisle and correcting errors, and then closing it again. So my fingers were wedged between the screen and the keys and typing. That was a thrill a minute, knowing that I had to finish that. Plus, you know, I was using all the tray space for the vodkas, so you know it was a problem. But the other one is I flew Continental once to Chicago, and I got on. It was the last seat on the plane, so I couldn't change seats. And I get there, and this is pre-9/11; they wouldn't let a plane take off like this now. And I get on, and the seat has no cushion, and so I sat on a piece of plywood all the way from D.C. to Chicago, and they offered me no assistance whatsoever. I always remember that. My last one is I flew to Boston to do a panel. And I stayed at this hotel, which was at the government rate in Boston. And it just smelled of death and Cheetos. And it was just the worst hotel in the world. And I decided I'm going to get a soda and some ice. So I walked to the vending thing. And I grabbed the soda. And as I go to reach into the ice pail, I realize the night shift has wedged about 12 beers into the ice. And they're using it as a cooler. So I figured I can't really use the ice because they've clearly been putting their hands in and everything else. So I figured the fair trade-off was I grabbed a couple of the beers and took them to my room and figured that evened everything out. And they never even noticed. So those would be mine. My travel out here was much nicer, I must say, and as will my travel home be, but I definitely had some shots at it. What do you think?
One thing I will always remember is Marty really knew how to take a vacation. Every year in the middle of the summer, Marty would take 2 weeks off and go to the Outer Banks, North Carolina with his family, and during that time, he knew generally not to try to reach him. Of course, he would always be available if he had to be, but for the most part, you knew he treasured this time away with his family so much that you really felt bad about disturbing him. And we talked about some of Marty's fond vacation memories on the Dave and Marty radio show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Back in the Saddle edition of the Dave and Marty radio show. We've been away on hiatus for a while. And Marty, I just wanted to thank you first for our comeback tour here, not replacing me with Ronnie James Dio.
Well, we remember, I mean, Heaven and Hell was not nearly the Black Sabbath album that the one before it had been, so there was no way I was going to replace Ozzy with Ronnie. Not happening. So what we're going to finish with is we always like to finish with a question that doesn't have anything to do with the securities laws. So I'm going to ask Dave first. And we've all just either gone on vacation or are about to go. And I'm going to ask Dave, what's your favorite vacation place in the whole world?
Well, I'd have to say it's probably the place I'm going in to at the end of next week, which is Cape May, New Jersey, which is a great place to go with the family. It's a nice, quiet beach. How about you? What's your favorite place?
My favorite place is the place I've gone. I'm 46 now, and I bet you I've gone there 30 years of those 46, which is Nags Head, North Carolina. I love to go to the Outer Banks, sit in a place where you can see the ocean, see the beach, see the kids running on it, have a couple of cold beers and listen to Jimmy Buffett in the sun and relax. And so I absolutely love Nags Head, North Carolina. And there are a couple of wonderful beachside bars down there that I've gotten to know the folks who run it because anybody knows I like the occasional happy hour. And so while we're on the topic, I'd like to, if anybody's ever down there, the Lucky 12 Tavern, BJ and Dylan and the boys behind the bar are wonderful guys. They'll take care of you. I'll take credit next year when their business goes up. So anyhow, that's my favorite place. If I could go and spend the rest of my life, it'd be Nags Head, North Carolina.
So you're back from Ireland. I thought maybe we could inventory some of our favorite things about Ireland in the various trips we've had there.
I'll give my three. The first is you come back. I was only there 6 days. You know, you come back with kind of a different attitude because the people are so relaxed. Everything is, you know, it is what it is. How's the day? Lovely. You know, I mean, everybody's always in a good mood. Maybe they're always hammered. I don't know. But they're always in a good mood, and that can't help you but being nicer. You know, and you benefit from that. My second favorite thing is there's a pub in Kinsale that is right off of the fort, I think it's Fort Charles, called The Spaniard. It was called The Castle for
400 years because or 300 years because it was first built in 1650. It was called the castle, and they changed the name in 1950 or 1960 or something like that to the Spaniard. And it is so cool to go in there and throw darts, and the place has been the same for 500 years. You know, it's just crazy. And we were in there. There were four of us. And we said to the bartender, hey, can you take our picture? And he goes, why don't you come back here behind the bar? I'll go out there and take it. Yeah, you know, I mean, that's how relaxed this place is. You've got to love the Spaniard. So I love that. And I discovered something on my last trip there, which is I made a very nice trip to the Jameson Distillery. And the folks there, of course, were fantastic. And little did I know that after a lifetime of having one thing I didn't drink, which was Jameson, I love it. I love Irish whiskey. So now there's nothing I won't drink. So it was a good trip. And those would be my things. The people, I love the Spaniard, and discovering Jameson this last trip was nice. It's a wonderful place. Truly, you know, as I said, you come back, you're just in a better frame of mind. They're great folks.
Absolutely. Well, thank you.
And the Irish won 50-10. Notre Dame beat Navy, so that was successful.
That's all we wanted to hear.
There you go.
Just about anyone who spent some time with Marty knows that he was like an encyclopedia when it came to rock and roll music. It never ceased to amaze me how much Marty knew about music. And not surprisingly, music was a topic that came up again and again in our conversations together.
And so with that in my mind, I wanted to ask Dave a very serious question, which is, gun to your head, favorite Van Morrison song?
Brown Eyed Girl.
Really? Straight up?
Absolutely.
Straight, going to the basics. You're driving your Camaro with the top down, listening to Brown Eyed Girl.
You better believe it.
Nothing wrong with that. It's a summer day in your mind when you think about that, isn't it? It's a straight-up summer day. The breeze is blowing through. Not that at all.
How about you?
I'm Bright Side of the Road. For me, it's such a rare, truly happy Van Morrison song. I love that song. It perks me up every time. And so that's my Van Morrison, although while I like that, I like the image of you, the carefree Dave Lynn, cruising in his Camaro, top down, brown-eyed girl, big smile on his face, and a non-alcoholic beverage in his hand. So good news. We'll end that on that very happy note. We're looking for the bright side of the road there. So
unfortunately, my Camaro was manufactured with minerals that could potentially be Tom's life minerals.
The number of minerals in there. And what you don't know is the dash is gold inlaid in Dave's. So that's how that goes. That's how he rolls.
Well, that reminds me, too, that to ask another question along those lines, which is, which Elvis do you prefer, Marty? The 1972 Elvis or the 1958 Elvis?
You know, it's amazing we've taken 27 shows to get to talking about Elvis, because anybody who knows me knows that I love Elvis. Elvis is Elvis, right? And I can still remember like it was yesterday. I was at a place called Howie's Sub Shop playing the Cleopatra pinball machine when it came over the radio in August of 77 that Elvis had died. And it stuns me how young he was because he seemed so old at the time. But my mom was a huge Elvis. It was a huge Elvis fan when he was alive. My mom's still alive, thank God. And so to me, I think about it, and usually you get the skinny Elvis, fat Elvis, which given me and Dave, we chose not to phrase it that way. But to me, it was never really the end game on Elvis because that was kind of a caricature by the end. And so I don't really think of it that way. And I don't think of the very early Elvis because it was before I was born. I was born in 63, you know. And so to me, it truly is kind of the movies Elvis, you know, just out of the military movies Elvis versus the comeback show and early Vegas Elvis, you know. So like those 10 years, where do you go? And when people ask me about Elvis, the Elvis I picture in my mind, so that's going to be my answer to this question, is when Elvis first started wearing the jumpsuits and had the longer hair and the big sideburns, but was still fairly thin and still really good looking, you know? And so I think I'd go like 68 to 73, maybe 70 to 73 Elvis. That to me is Elvis, you know? He was pretty much past making the movies, although the one with Mary Tyler Moore is really good.
It's a funny movie.
I'll have to say.
I will agree with you on that.
And still hadn't broken his heart completely yet, you know, and he wasn't singing things like, you don't have to say you love me, you know, he was so depressed all the time, and he still had energy in it and some life to it, and that to me is the Elvis. Now, you know, I'm a complete loser. On the way home the other night, I was listening to the radio, because my car doesn't have a CD player, and I heard Aerosmith, Train Kept a Rollin', which is a great song, and it got me thinking, what's the best song with Train, either in the title or as its motif? And so I think I have mine, but there's so many of them. I'm going to let Dave go with his first.
Yeah, that's a tough one. And of course, I am kind of a Train geek, I will have to admit. And that probably lends.
Really, 39 acting trains in a row? In a row?
And it probably arises from the fact that I've spent a significant portion of the last 15 years of my life wasted riding on trains back and forth to Washington, but I have like a big train set up that I put up at Christmas time. I'm like, you know, kind of a train geek. And in fact, I was very happy when Marty assigned the office of the chief counsel to overlook the train yard at Union Station. That was the dream come true for me.
I tend to think more of the obvious ones, which I'm not going to go with, but I love Train Train by Blackfoot.
Oh, yeah.
You can't do better than Love Train by the OJs. I thought of Folsom Prison Blues by Johnny Cash. But at the end of the day, I come back to my classic from when I was a teenager that I still love, that I sang at my friend Brian's wedding, which is Midnight Train to Georgia. I think, and of course, I had all the friends from high school being the Pips. And it's an actual train. They're talking about he's on the Midnight Train to Georgia, so it's not all metaphysical like yours. But I just think that's a great song. Great lyrics, great theme, great Pips. You know, it's the whole deal. I got to go Midnight Train to Georgia. Although, man, I could listen to Can't You See all day. You know, it's just good stuff. So Dave and I travel a lot, as everybody I'm sure knows. And we were emailing the other day, and we got into a discussion about the song Turn the Page by Bob Seger, which is, no doubt, one of the great classic rock songs of our time. I find it to be great. Every time it comes on, I can't help but listen to it. And so the question was, though, if you think about Bob Seger, he's had a long career, and he's got some great songs and some songs that really bug me. And so the question we have tonight is Bob Seger, yes or no? And with me, the yes or no is, would you buy his greatest hits album? Would you drop album? God, I'm old. Would you buy his greatest hits CD? Would you drop $15.99 or whatever it would cost for the collection of songs that would be on that CD? See, I'm torn on this one because there are three Seger songs that to me are just great. Turn the Page, as I mentioned. I think Night Moves is one of the great recorded songs of all time. I mean, a 60 Chevy. We've all seen a 60 Chevy. You love it. And then I think Kathmandu is one of the great live songs of all time. And so you're there. And then if you've ever seen the movie Body Heat, there's a great scene where Mickey Rourke is lip syncing to Feel Like a Number, which is a very good song. You know, to the IRS, I'm another file and all that. So I have three or four Seger songs from the mid-70s to the late-70s that I absolutely love, right? But then you get into Still the Same and Hollywood Nights and Against the Wind and that cruddy song that was on Beverly Hills Cop 2 or whatever, and I just can't do it anymore. I think there are four songs that if they come on, it's great, but I would not drop the money. And plus, I hate old-time rock and roll because it's in Risky Business, and Tom Cruise is not my favorite actor and all that stuff. So I think at the end of the day, three or four songs I love. If you'd asked me in 1979, I would have been totally in, and I had Live Bullet, and I had all those, you know. But I think now, I just don't think it makes it. So I'm hoping that we can find a way to use the technology to, if we get on the website with this thing, to take a little poll on this topic, because I'd like to see what everybody else thinks about that.
Yeah, hopefully we won't have to amend 1484 to do that.
It's one or two topics, yes or no. And you can't abstain. Yeah, you can't abstain. There's no abstaining.
And I have a piece of advice for you. They invented this thing called iTunes where you can actually just get those three songs. You don't have to buy the whole album.
Yeah, but is it a good topic to say, would you buy Night Moves? Everybody would buy Night Moves. Come on. It's a great song.
Hi, this is Marty Dunn. This is the Dave and Marty Radio Show, our second episode since returning from hiatus. And we're going to talk about a few things tonight regarding our favorite topic, securities laws, because we really have no life. But since I get to introduce this show, by the way, I'm Marty Dunn. I'm at O'Melveny, and Dave, you all know from his website and the fact that he's on it and he gets his name first because he's a big shot. So with that, we always talk about securities law, and Dave always introduces it and then gets very serious and talks about securities law first. And then I have to talk about like a matter that nobody cares about, but I like to talk about at the end. So instead, we're going to start this time with our favorite concerts this year. I've not been to many of them, but I've been to three or four this year that I absolutely loved. And so I'm going to start talking about my favorite concerts of the year. And I'm trying to rank my top three in order. And my top three are, got to see Springsteen and the E Street Band, got to see AC/DC, and I got to see Carole King and James Taylor, all at the Verizon Center this year. And I actually thought of the three that I was going to go to Carole King and James Taylor and be horribly bored, because, you know, I try to think I'm not as old as I am. The fact of the matter is, they were amazing. They killed in every song you knew, and I don't know that I could rate them above or below the other two as much as I love the other two bands. That was absolutely incredible. I had a blast. I was with people I care a lot about. We had a very good time. On AC/DC, I really thought it was going to be kind of pathetic, that I was going to go and see a lot of guys in black concert tees from the mid-80s, and Brian Johnson was going to have no voice at all and was just going to scream like Steven Tyler, and it wasn't going to go very well. And they killed. Angus continues to kill. They went 2.5 hours, and it could have gone all night long. It was a blast. And, of course, Springsteen was great.
So those were my three favorites. I had an absolute blast at each of them and would recommend anybody who ever gets the chance to see any of them to do it. So with that, what do you think, Dave? What was your best concert this year?
Well, I wasn't really at any concerts this year. You didn't invite me to any of those, I guess, because I'm not one of your favorite people. So I ended up really not seeing any concerts. I've just been working on things like the Dodd-Frank Act, I guess. But
well, you like how in doing that, Dave managed to, instead of making it sound like he was pathetic for not seeing any concerts, make it sound like it was my fault, which is such a load of it. But if once you know Dave, you'll know that that's how it rolls. So at any rate, on the concert front, I win. Just saying. If we're keeping track, one for Marty on this one.
Marty loved the SEC and the Division of Corporation Finance very much. He did so much incredible work while he was there, and he connected with so many people along the way. It should come as no surprise that we often recounted our fond memories of that time in our lives.
What we thought we'd talk about tonight is, you know, I had 19 years at the SEC. Dave and his various incarnations had
10.
And we talk about things that we remember most fondly while we were there and try to whittle it down to one thing that always sticks with us. And because of that, it's not going to be probably people or particular things we worked on, because there were so many people and things that I loved the folks there. I actually absolutely loved a number of the projects. Some of them I endured, of course. But, you know, I love some of them. And trying to think about the one thing that just sticks in our mind when we think about something there that we just enjoyed or made us feel good. Well, with mine, I don't know if this will seem kind of weird because I was there so long, but the one thing that always sticks with me that just kind of gave me the warmest feeling of the whole thing is one of my favorite people at the commission was a guy named Bill Carter. Bill worked in chief counsel's office with me for years and is a wonderful guy and a good lawyer and a good friend. And he had his going away party after, 25 or 28 years or something. And anybody who knows Mr. Carter knows he's an incredibly modest man. He would never tell you what he's doing. He's, you know, a very private man. And he brought his children there. And so he had his family there, which was kind of a big deal because I hadn't remembered them being there before. And what most people don't know is that Mr. Carter did the hiring for 20 years. People who work there know, but outside they wouldn't know that. And so I was lucky enough to say a few remarks at Bill's party, and his family was standing next to me. And we had it when we first rearranged the fourth floor at 450 Fifth Street. So we had a huge area between the director, the deputy director, and the OCC area where we could have a party there. And I was standing on a milk crate or something yelling at people with a beer in my hand, I'm sure. And I was saying something for Bill. And I realized his family, he probably never told them what he did or how significant he was to everybody there, because everybody he hired, he made our careers. He gave us the chance to have the careers we had. And so I said, for Bill's family, I just want everybody here who's a lawyer, who Bill is responsible for hiring you, to raise your hand. And everybody in the room raised their hand. And I just remember Bill's the look on their family that they had no idea how important he had been to all of us. And that just made me feel great that I had the chance to be able to be there when that happened. And the chance to work with Bill was great. So that would always be mine. That always gives me a smile when I think.
Marty was, of course, a huge Notre Dame fan, having spent his undergraduate years there. And no walk down memory lane would be complete without at least one Notre Dame story.
Yeah, I wonder if that brings to mind any fond snow-related memories that you have there, Marty.
The one I always remember about snow is, you know, I went to school at Notre Dame, and South Indy Lake Effect snows where we dumped 30 inches on the campus in, you know, 6 hours or 10 hours or something ridiculous. And one day, Notre Dame, it was a weekend, Notre Dame was playing UCLA, and it was a blizzard condition. It was below zero visibility, basically. Snow was just coming down in buckets, and so the administration did not allow us to go watch the game. So it was broadcast on NBC in front of an empty auditorium. I'll always remember that. But it was a Saturday, of course, which meant the night before had been a Friday, so there were no necessary supplies around the dorm. And so we all drew straws in our group, and the two people who lost, my dear friends Walt O'Connor and Fat Dave Desaunier, were required to walk the quarter to a half a mile to the liquor store to get supplies and come back. And we weren't quite sure how they were going to pull this off, because there were like 20 of us they were supposed to be getting, you know, beer for and chips for or whatever. And about an hour later, remember, this is pre-cell phone days, so we had no idea what they were up to. It had been an hour. We're all waiting around towards the front door, and they come trudging back in just the worst conditions you can imagine. And they borrowed some kid's wagon, one of the radio flyer-type wagons, and we're pulling it behind him with just stacked like a camel full of supplies. And it was one of the happiest moments of my life. I'll always remember that. I've always respected Dave and Walt for pulling that off. So that's the one. That probably is as pleasant a snow experience as I can come up with. You know, of course, I got sledding as a kid, but all that stuff's boring. But that would probably be my favorite.
Marty and I were incredibly fortunate to have the careers that we have had, both in government and in private practice. But sometimes it was fun to envision what we might have been doing if we had not gone to the SEC and ended up on the path that we followed.
Well, I think with that, I'll ask you a question about something more important. What do you think you'd be up to right now if you weren't a securities lawyer, Marty?
That's interesting. I wouldn't be having as much fun, probably. Or I don't know. I might be having. I enjoy this a lot. And I've thought about it a lot. If I just bagged all this, what would I do? And I go back to what I did probably as a teenager that I enjoyed the most. It was my summer and weekend jobs, which is landscaping. I absolutely loved working outdoors. I absolutely loved doing nothing other than laying sod or digging a hole or doing something simple, because there's definitely a sense of completion when you do it. There's a sense of taking a step back and saying, that's amazing, we pulled that off. Whereas in securities law, it's kind of like, oh, okay, and you move on to the next thing. You know, there's not that absolute sense of, I can take a picture of this and prove something I just did. And so I would probably do that. I was a good landscaper. I was a terrible mechanic, so I wouldn't go back to doing that. I was actually a really good clerk typist. I was a GS-1 clerk typist at USDA, and I enjoyed that job, and I was good at it, and it was pretty direct, and I liked that. But I think big picture, I'd be digging a ditch somewhere.
If you had stayed with that typist job, you might have been up to like GS-2, GS-3.
I would have been under the Reagan retirement plan. It would have been much better. I might still be at the government. Well, I will say one thing that relates my landscaping experience to what I do now. And I found the most important thing landscapers don't do is they don't finish the job. They finish and they walk away, and they don't do that last little bit to tidy it up, what I call sweeping the curb. So when the homeowner shows up, the curb is perfect, it's beautiful, everything is clean. And similarly, as a securities lawyer, I see a lot of people who don't quite finish the job. They aren't worried about that last little bit of perfection. I always refer to that as sweeping the curb. And so I think they're two similar professions in that what somebody walks in and sees is what sells, and you got to finish the job. And so that to me, that ties them together.
Well, those are words to live by. I guess to wrap things up, I will say this, that all this stuff that's very interesting to us is sort of been
sad.
A lot of our focus.
No.
But most of the questions I get from reporters all day long is about crowdfunding. So my question to you, Marty, is if you were to avail yourself of crowdfunding once it gets adopted and wanted to raise up to $1 million, what would you raise it for?
I've thought about this a lot because I've always had the dream, you know, and I'm a simple person. I've always wanted to live on the beach and have like a hot dog stand. You know, just something very simple and just kind of walk up and down the boardwalk and be that guy that drives everybody crazy and the hot dog stand keeps me busy. And how much can a hot dog stand cost, right? Certainly, hopefully,
you
less
get all the hot dogs you ever
all
want.
The hot dogs you can eat. So hopefully it would be less than $1 million. So that would seem like the obvious answer. However, I've been thinking about this a lot since this came up, and I've decided $1 million is not enough money to make me be beholden to public shareholders. I want my hot dog stand. So I don't think there's anything I would do with crowdfunding money, given the fact that I'd have to raise less than $10,000 from a person. So what am I looking at? A thousand people that I'd owe responsibility to. I can't see that being worth it. So I'm going to go with nothing.
Yeah,
there's my answer.
How about you?
I like it. Well,
I was looking on a crowdfunding site the other day, and the featured offering was indeed a hot dog stand. And you know, if you look at crowdfunding sites today, they're heavily weighted towards hot dog stands, fondue stations, and independent movies made by, like, teenagers and stuff like that.
Thank you all for joining me for this tribute to Marty Dunn. I hope that hearing Marty's voice and his laugh was as good for you as it was for me.